We're in chapter 11, and we're starting with verse 7. Hey, verse 7, and Alex, since you are here today, I'd like to read.
Oh.
I would like you to read verses 7. I'm going to have you read a long passage. Well, wait a minute. Not so long. I just made a change my mind, like a true woman. Verses 7 to 12.
Okay, so I'm reading from the New Revised Standard Version. By faith, Noah, warned by God about events as yet unseen, respected the warning and built an ark to save his household. By this, he condemned the world and became an heir to the righteousness that is in accordance with faith. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to set out for a place that he was to receive as an inheritance, and he set out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he stayed for a time in the land he had been promised, as in a foreign land, living in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked forward to the city that has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, he received power of procreation, even though he was too old and Sarah herself was barren, because he considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one person, and this one as good as dead, descendants were born, as many as the stars of heaven and as the innumerable grains of sand by the seashore.
I think whoever translated this verse in Hebrews, verse 11, was a feminist interpreter of the text. By faith, even Sarah received the ability to have a child, though she herself was barren and past the age for having children, because she believed that the one who promised was faithful.
Interesting. Which version do you have?
The Common English Bible.
Ah.
It's a fairly evangelical translation, and it has one Adventist translator on it.
Oh, I didn't
Not Hebrews. He
know.
translated, I think he translated Leviticus and maybe Numbers. And then verse 12 is interesting. So descendants were born from one man, and he was as good as dead. Goes back to the masculine. But that's interesting about by faith, even Sarah received the ability to have a child. I like it. I wish the Greek actually said that.
What does it say?
It says Abraham. It's all about Abraham, progendering a child.
Yeah, Sarah's kind of a parenthetical.
Yeah.
Well, I've got the New King James, and it seems to be the same basic idea. It says, by faith, Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age because she judged him faithful who had promised.
What happened to the NRSV then?
I know, seriously. Anyone got other translations? We gotta, this is interesting.
I'm gonna check out a new. I have a new, fairly new NRSV. My old one has kind of given up the ghost.
The New Living Translation talks about Sarah. It's by faith that even Sarah was able to have a child when she was barren for 2 months.
I want because I wonder if the NRSV has been edited any time in recent years. Like the NIV, you know, that you would have to get the newest translation to find the new NIV because they edit.
So I'm using an online version and I'm seeing a copyright 1989.
Oh, maybe that's it. Well, I'm looking at this one. It's leather bound. There we go, Hebrews.
I could read the New Revised Standard Version Catholic edition.
I don't know that that would help.
I've got an anglicized Catholic edition.
The version of the Good News Bible I have basically follows what you read too. It mentions Sarah, but doesn't really do much more than make it parenthetical.
Yeah, by faith he received the power of procreation, even though he was too old, and Sarah herself was barren because he considered himself faithful. And there's a footnote. Oh, or by faith Sarah herself, though barren. So they admit, you can translate it the other way.
Interesting. So- I missed that footnote.
Gender-neutral pronoun, then?
You know, you want me to look it up?
No, it's okay. I mean,
the footnote that I saw was that there are different ancient texts, and some infer one, and some infer the other.
Okay.
And so that I don't know what those are, but that's my footnote.
I do want to look it up now because I want to see what kind of rating. And that's verse 11, okay? 11:11. So this one has Sarah believed also believed him, though unable to bear. And my Greek is rusty. Some of this language I have never learned, but I can make out that those lines, so that it's talking about Sarah. And there's a two, and it says, gives the Sarah reading, P46, that's a papyrus, ancient papyrus, which means it's the earliest manuscript. D, psi, and then, and also Sarah believed him. Well, has a whole bunch of manuscripts from it. And then there's another Sarah reading. Sarah is in every textual critical reading. So I don't know what happened to the NRSV. Some very anti-feminist person must have gotten their hands on it. That's very unusual for the NRSV, because the NRSV was the first translation to use, what do they call it? Gender neutral language, you know. I should say gender inclusive language.
Which was the first?
NRSV.
Oh.
The one that we're struggling with.
Yeah. So looking back at, the Jonathan Gallagher's Free Bible version, he says, by her trust in God, even Sarah herself was given the ability, and with a footnote, some versions say Abraham. But so now if I go back and look at the Good News Bible, they basically put both of them in there. It was by faith, it was faith that made Abraham able to become a father, even though he was too old, and Sarah herself, who could not have children. So they kind of put them both in there.
Okay, I'm going back to this. Not to Hebrews 12, but to Hebrews 11:11. I don't find Abraham in there. And then all the other textual variants, there's no Abraham, unless I'm just not wanting to see it. After our discussion this morning, I think maybe I better relook at this. I don't see where even Jonathan Gallagher gets that. I guess I would have to translate it.
I was reading, that was the Good News Bible.
Oh, that was
Jonathan Gallagher just said Sarah with a footnote that said Abraham.
You know, I'll bet if we looked at the King James Version. I don't have the King James Version, but I would guess.
I can look it up here.
It just has, through faith also Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed.
King James Version has that?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. I think David had mentioned that too.
Where in the world did the NRSV get it? And Good News Bible. I just find out I can't find Abraham anywhere in that verse. And any of the variants. Well,
so Jonathan Gallagher did have some say Abraham in a footnote.
Some manuscripts say it.
You know what has happened? Those manuscripts have been completely removed from the textual apparatus because they are so recent. They no longer seem valid. Because the ancient manuscripts, the most ancient manuscripts have Sarah.
That's interesting. Because like I'm also noticing he's doing a progression here. He's talking about Abel by faith, Noah by faith, Abraham by faith.
But no, it couldn't be, some scribes said, no, it couldn't be Sarah. It had to be Abraham.
Right? That's interesting.
Got a woman in here. Women don't belong in the Hall of Faith fame.
Right.
Oh. Wow. Like Julius and...
We kind of got sidetracked on that. What is your response to, we have Noah by faith. By faith, Abraham obeyed.
I thought it was interesting, at least in the Good News Bible, that they said by faith, Noah set out and built a boat. No, it says by faith, Noah was able to hear, which I'd never noticed before.
Yeah, he respected the warning.
I have by faith, Noah responded with godly fear when he was warned about events he had not seen yet.
Serious attention is how Free Bible Version. Noah paid serious attention to what God said.
Yeah, so he starts out, Noah trusted God, which he would do, and was warned by him.
Well, the word faith means trust.
The good news says he was able to hear.
But it was faith that made Noah hear God's warning about things in the future that he could not see, and he obeyed God and built a boat.
So is that sort of like, I mean, obviously when you trust someone deeply, you can hear them well. We were talking before the recording about our paradigms and assumptions sometimes block us from hearing what someone's actually saying. And so I'm wondering if in this case, when we, whatever level of trust we have, we're able to hear God a certain amount. And the Hall of Fame is showing us that whatever trust they had, they were listening. Because isn't listen, hear, also infer obedience?
Well, the word to obey, both in Hebrew and in Greek, mean to listen. With Hebrew, it's just to listen. With a Greek, it's to listen under.
Listen under meaning because you're
listening with due respect, I think, is the concept. Oh,
okay.
And so I see that playing out. Noah trusting, paying serious attention, constructing the ark. And there is a consequence to that, showing that by doing that, the world is wrong. Abraham does the same thing. He listens and goes where God has called him, even though he didn't know where that was. Sarah, willing to conceive, well, not just willing to conceive, willing to bear the child of promise. It conjures up, I forget where it is. Is it Timothy, James? Faith without works is dead. And it's not about behavioral works for salvation or anything, but it's a trust that I think Paul would say expresses itself through love, which is action, not passive.
Right. You could say active trust. I know, trust that acts. Well, shall we move on to verses 13 to 16? And who shall I pick on? Bill?
Yeah, to 16. Okay, 13 to 16. And I'm reading from the Free Bible Version. They all died still trusting in God. Though they didn't receive the things God promised, they were still looking for them, as it were, from a distance and welcomed them, acknowledging that on this earth they were foreigners, people just passing through. People who say such things make it clear that they're looking for a country of their own. For if they cared about the country they'd left behind, they could have returned. But they're looking for a better country instead, a heavenly country. That is why God isn't disappointed with them and is happy to be called their God, for he has built a city for them.
I like that what the Common English Bible says, that they were looking for a homeland.
Which verse is that, Jean? Oh, 15? Oh, no.
14. 14. The end of 14. There's a hymn you may know, an old hymn that was built on these verses. I'm but a stranger here. Heaven is my home. I was a small child when we took in a student to the academy, Laurelwood Academy, where my father was teaching. For, I think she came for a Thanksgiving break. And she wanted to help with the dishes after the evening meal. And so she was doing the dishes and she was singing, I'm but a stranger here, heaven is my home. And that song struck me as so sad. And I thought, oh, this poor girl, what has she gone through? So I pulled my mom aside and I said, Mommy, what's wrong with her? What's she going through? And Mom said, well, she's away from home. She lived in Canada. She's a long way from home. And this isn't home. So she's singing that hymn. So there's another song, This World Is Not My World.
And I'm a poor widow.
This world is not. Oh, sorry. I mistyped that. This world is not my home. I'm just a passing through.
Yeah, but there's that contemporary kind of folk song that we used to sing.
I was trying to copy from a website and it wasn't pasting. So I typed it and I don't know why I said this world is not my world, but this world is not my home.
You knew what you meant. And it's that spiritual, so said too. You know, I'm just a poor, wayfaring stranger. Mm-hmm. You can see how they'd feel that way with what they went through.
Yeah. But at this point in time, they're longing for a better country that is a heavenly one. Therefore, God isn't ashamed to be called their God. He has prepared a city for them. Now, it's interesting, the city motif that is rejected in the Tower of Babel story. And there's good reasons for that rejection. With urbanization, we lost the family model. And it became, instead of being in a family setting, it became more important to do good in your workplace and make good. Here, the city comes back. But this time, it's a heavenly city. And what kind of city is that? We'll find out when we get to Revelation.
Do we get glimpses? I guess part of me is like, they were looking for, they recognized they were sojourners in a foreign land. I mean, that seems true for all of the early descriptors. And if the promise is that future thing, it seems like Paul or the author of Hebrews, and then of course we have the New Testament, depending on how they understood the character of God being played out in government, and I government is quotation marks, that is very different from everything that they had experienced. I can't help but also think that there's a, I'm trying to remember how the brass, is it the brass age? That was beginning to...
Bronze age?
The bronze, thank you. Yeah, all of it. The Bronze Age is ending right about the time, you know, it's beginning to fall apart, and it really falls apart during the Exodus or something about like that. So it's like what was known was falling apart, couldn't be trusted. So their sojourning was evidence of a people or person willing to not trust what they could see, but what was still ahead of them. So I see that playing out here, and that which is promised was so much more than anything they had known or could have known. I don't know if that makes sense. I just see that groundwork in Hebrews.
Well, you think about the parallels here. Enoch was so close to God, walking so close to God, it was like he was in heaven already. So God just took him to heaven. So he got to see that home. But Noah had to get on a boat and spend a year on it. And with animals who probably got increasingly wild as that year went on. And then Abraham has to leave a city and go progressively. He left or part way, came to Haran, which was a small village, probably. And the people were semi-nomadic. And then he becomes a full nomad when he goes to Canaan. So he has to, there's, if you look at these stories as a whole, there's a decided rejection. Before the flood, you have the creation of cities by Cain and his descendants. There's this rejection of it and the boat and the flood and the coming out to nature. And then Abraham, decided rejection, coming out of the city, semi-nomadism to full nomadism. It is a rejection of the city. But for some reason, God brings back the city and the heavenly one. And I haven't figured out why. I haven't figured out what the purpose of that city is. Is it to help people feel comfortable who are used to living in cities, which are many, many people now on planet Earth? Or what is the reason for a heavenly city?
My understanding, or at least the conclusion that I've come to on this is, well, one is that once we get to heaven and we all actually reflect God's character, it's safe to bring a lot of people close together, whereas it isn't now. But I don't think, from what I can see, just the bits and pieces we get of what heaven's going to be like, I don't think that is going to be our permanent, it's going to be our apartment in the city, a place that we can come to every Sabbath when we come together to worship. But that during the rest of the week, I think we'll be scattered out across the universe.
Hmm.
And because it says, we'll
true after the
homes and vineyards and things that and tasks that God has put us in charge of, other cities and other things, other places. And so I don't think that we'll be spending all of our time in the city.
And unlike those who dream of mansions in heaven, it's really in my Father's house are many rooms.
Right.
I think we're going to be shocked at how small our place is. It's not going to be a place where we have company and we have food and all of that. It's going to be more of a place to rest maybe for a little bit before going to other places, other things.
Yeah. I wonder if the community if the city is a nod to community and getting beyond just the family connections to a broader connection.
Now, me lived in a garden. I want a garden. I don't want a house.
I'm going to look at this up. Verse 16. It's polis. Polis in Greek, which does mean city. But does anybody know ancient Greek history and how polis really was? Mm-mm. I forget. It's been too many years since I heard about that.
How do you spell it?
Polis, P-O-L-I-S.
The polis refers to the city-state, and the most famous one was Athens, was the first polis, the city-state, which the citizens governed over.
Okay. It has to do with citizenship.
Oh, so our citizenship is in heaven.
Yes.
Okay, but they lived out in the fields.
So the city exemplifies citizenship, which means we are there because we belong there. We are citizens of that place. It's sort of like everybody wears a crown in heaven. Everybody's king, but nobody's king because everybody's king.
Everybody's servant king. You know what I mean?
Well, I just find it funny. You know, in Craterville Sabbath School, they used to make these little hat crowns that were gold, put it on our heads, and we sang that I will wear a crown in my father's house.
Did you put little watches on them?
No, they were just plain. Well, there were little stars put on them.
Yeah, you don't want any jewelry on there. Just exactly. No gems.
Has to be functional.
You've heard the joke Dr. Graham Maxwell told about the crown.
Yeah, well, actually, that came from Dr. Bravancha.
Oh,
Bravancha. I said that he thought that because we can't have jewelry. He was serious about this. So if we can't have jewelry, that there will be watches or something. There will be something functional.
Bravancha was serious about it.
Actually, Dr. Bravancha used to say that. Yeah. And then Dr. Maxwell kind of turned it into a joke, but
you're gonna have a crown with a clock in the middle because we can watches, but we can't.
I think it was kind of a joke for Dr. Bravancha as well.
I would think so too.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I was gonna say I love science fiction and because it stretches the boundaries of what's possible, and my own. Writing attempts at what it's going to look like in hereafter is, so I have this mansion up on a cliff above the sea, and in one of the rooms is a portal that winds me up in my room in the city. So there's no contradiction between having a mansion and being in the city at the same time.
Well, I has not seen nor ear heard, so we'll see what we have when we get there. I just think that this is not the same kind of city that we build on Earth.
Yeah, the cities on Earth, like Babel, it was all built on oppression, I heard, you know, that.
Oppression, yeah. Slavery.
Yeah, I forget where I heard it, but the expression ivory tower is kind of related to that, where the elite were at the top and all the slaves, all the masses were below. And so...
You can explain it that way, but the actual tower functioned in a religious kind of tower sense. And nobody knows for sure what that was. They've not been able to excavate anything that would give them any idea that the tower was useful.
With that, it was useful.
The thought is, I think most scholars think that it was intended to draw the gods down to Babylon.
Oh.
Or whatever's every city, every ancient Mesopotamian city had a temple with a temple tower. The earliest one was Eridu, which is the earliest city. This temple tower never got built or never got finished. And so it could be the Tower of Babel.
Yeah. Ellen White talks about all the oppression and cruelty that was involved in building this, and that people were crying out for rescue to God. And I can't see that in the text. I know Jonathan's daughter, Abigail, was talking kind of about, just trying to remember what she said, if she was the one that talked about the ivory tower thing or what. But anyway, I'm interested in what you were going to say.
With the invention, a city is mentioned in Genesis 11 before the tower. So it's a city and a tower. That's important because before there were cities, there were villages. Some villages were egalitarian and some villages were oppressive, had hierarchy. And with the invention of the city, oppression and hierarchy and all those things came into play. So the temple tower does symbolize that the reach of the family. So instead of having a family model to by which you live life for your society, you now had a workplace model. And it was, your life was centered around work and climbing the ladder and getting prestige and honor and money and wealth. That seems to be how it worked. And there definitely had to be hierarchy, because how could you have that many people on that small space and not have that?
And it seems like, you know, even families get into the hierarchy, you know, I mean, the whole patriarchy thing, even families, everybody's vying for power sometimes, you know. It just seems to be an inherent mess up in our psyches.
It definitely is. I have an excellent book on that. The last half of the book isn't as good, but I used the first half predominantly to work on something. It's by Mario Liverani, an Italian scholar, who has tried to put that whole Mesopotamian picture together and develop the whole way society took place, how it grew and how it developed. And he's the one I'm using when I say that the shift from family to the workplace took place.
So people started grasping for more power even outside the family and stuff.
I think you can make a good case that the use of power and the acquisition of power is what the great controversy is all about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Satan and his followers want to acquire and use power for their own good, and God's way is to use his power for the benefit of others.
I was just about to invoke Mark on that. because of our many conversations. And what came to me in terms of a Bible text that really reveals God's mentality is John 13. Jesus knew he had come from the Father, I'm paraphrasing, Jesus had come from the Father, was returning, that all authority in the heaven and earth were his. And he took up the basin and the towel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a complete flipping of this power script.
It is complete. Well, another good place to use that model is for the humility model. I'm trying to think which book of Paul is. Is it Ephesians? Philippians. Philippians 2. That though he was God, he gave up his godness. And he, you know, and he came down and became one with us and became a servant. If you can put that right next to Isaiah 14 that describes the fall of Lucifer from power hungry to nothing, and you have an actual complete antithesis.
I was thinking even too in the Garden of Eden, you know, God came and walked with him every day in the cool of the evening. And yet they were so dazzled by, Eve was so dazzled by this serpent, you know, who just, you know, when they fly,
they
talk.
He promised them power.
Yeah. But God evidently didn't come to them in this dazzling array that the serpent did.
And by telling them, you will be like God, he denied that they were created in the image of God already. It's just, but they got terribly duped. Shall we move on to verse 17? Katrina, I'd like to hear your voice, even though we can't see you. Would you read verses 17? Oh, where shall we stop? I think it's 22. 17 to 22, please.
By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called. concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning on the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones.
I want to shed a little bit of light on the offering of Isaac. An earlier Sabbath school, which you were present, I was able to unpack the nature of the story and how the point that God was trying to make is no, you don't offer your children as a sacrifice, and no, I won't be killing my son. Those two points. But there's another point. The rabbis believed that this testing, God's testing of Abraham, was parallel to Job, and that it was the Satan who demanded the test.
That's interesting. The one thing that I've kind of come to conclude out of that whole process was that part of it was and that actually would fit in with what you're saying here, was that the test was whether God, whether Abraham held in higher esteem the gift or the giver, and that Isaac was the physical representation of everything that God had promised to him. Was Abraham willing to give that up? And did he consider his relationship with God to be more important than everything that God had given him?
Gene, I really like the idea that it was Satan who prompted that, just like Job. I have always thought that it said terrible things about God, that God would go down to ask Abraham, who grew up in a culture where this was not an unheard of thing, that God, it seems to be testing beyond what he's able to bear. I've always had a trouble with the idea that was God asking him to do that, just to see what he'd do.
In Desire of Ages, it says that Satan had accused Abraham. He'd accused him. So in that sense, he did kind of prompt the test. And so God said, okay, we'll have a test of Abraham's faith. But Abraham had also prayed to see Christ and what that was going to all be about. And so he understood in a way he never could before about what God was going to go through. I mean, he had reasoned in his heart that God could bring his son back from the dead. Mm-hmm. Abraham had. Yeah. And so he felt like, okay, I don't know what God's up to here, but I'll trust him because he's always come through before. But he'd had this vision before God said, sacrifice your son. And he may have known something was up regarding that too, you know, that God had told him, I will sacrifice my son to save humanity. And then he says, now, Abraham, you know, I need you to sacrifice your son. And because Abraham had prayed, please help me understand, you know, what this is all about.
So I'm kind of curious. Obviously, Hebrews and the original Genesis rendering could infer different things. But Jonathan has, in the Free Bible version, translated, Abraham trusted God when he was tested and offered Isaac to God. So it does leave it open in the Hebrews account that it wasn't God doing the initiation.
It was just tested.
But that there was a test and there was a prompting to do this. He could certainly think of it in certain ways. I think it still goes to David's thing that Abraham was looking and saying, it's more important to me. I mean, and this is supported by the text in Hebrews, the relationship. And I keep thinking, what if Adam had felt the same way and said, you know what? I'm going to talk to God first. Eve, you've had your fruit. I'm going to wait and see what God has to say. It seems to me that that, like Job, all of God doesn't tempt. You know, I mean, that's the scriptural thing. God tempts no one. So where did these temptations and tests, and I think we generate it. I think it comes from the adversary to paint God poorly. I just see that as a biblical theme running throughout, and certainly is evident in Job.
Well, I'd like to suggest that this story really typifies what Rabbi Sachs contends, that the name Elohim is about justice, represents justice. Well, along with that, I have found in my study of the word Elohim that it represents God in, possibly represents God in the court setting, which would fit with what Sachs suggests. That's what you have at the beginning of the story. God tested Abraham. It's Ha Elohim, the God, or the gods, literally. But in Hebrew, in the Hebrew Bible, generally, they don't use it as plural. All the verbs that follow it will be singular. So when the gods tested, it's singular verb. So what I think is happening is there is a court setting, because the angel of Yahweh is who stops Abraham. So you have the court setting with El Ha Elohim, and you have Ha Yahweh, who is this God of love, mercy, compassion, and relationship, who comes down and says, don't do it, Abraham. That's just a little add on to what I presented earlier.
Yeah, Elohim, is that also used to describe angels in some settings? It's, you know, heavenly.
I think there's some scholarly discussion about that as a possibility, but I'm not sold on it exactly, because the angels are mentioned separately, like the angel of Yahweh, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, I heard it can be translated majestic heavenly beings.
It could be, possibly. But I think really in this case, you're dealing with a court case, and just Hasatan was not known in Abraham's time. You don't have the Satan until Job, and Job is post-exilic.
Yeah.
And you don't have it until Zechariah, which is also post-exilic. So why would it be in the story of Abraham? And that's why I think the rabbis really legitimately parallel it with Job and say, well, of course the Satan was demanding this. Heavenly courts, Bill. Never.
We say a courtroom scene, and immediately I conjure up legal courts like what we see.
Well, there's two courts. There's two courts in heaven. There's a legal court and there's a cosmological court. I'm kind of playing here, but I'm half serious. Satan has his court and God has his court.
So for Satan, it's he's making legal accusations.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
In the universe, God is saying,
As Ellen White puts it, he had this unwarranted desire for justice on a level that just wasn't godly.
His definition of justice is way different than God's definition of justice, it seems. You know, his is very eye for eye, and God's is no. That's I think it says it was abhorrent to God to say that's justice. He's just and merciful to forgive us our sins. That's justice. So they want to each, you know, set forth a different definition of justice before the universe, it seems to me.
Anyway, I think that's enough on that verse. It's, to me, it's interesting that he trusted God so much that he resolved it in his mind that he would rise from the dead, mm-hmm. that God could raise him from the dead. And no one had ever been, there's no story at the time of Abraham, before the time of Abraham, during the time of Abraham, of God raising anyone from the dead. But Abraham so trusted God, he figured out, you know, he created us in the beginning, he can just raise from the dead.
he knew he was supposed to have, you know, a lot of nations coming from him. So he's, God's either a liar or that's what he's going to do.
Yeah. It appears that, and we have to realize this, this is the hard truth. Abraham was more concerned about Isaac being the progenitor of inheritance than he was about child sacrifice.
I remember Rabbi Sacks saying every self-respecting God in Abraham's day asked for a child sacrifice, at least one of your kids. And this whole bit about the firstborn is mine, you have to redeem your firstborn, the firstborn belongs to me, is that from the pagan culture? And that God's drawing on that?
Interesting question.
Buy your firstborn back from me, you know, because all the other gods said that.
I think he probably was addressing that and saying, no, you don't kill them, you redeem them.
Oh, why they kill them?
That's in Exodus. I have a book in my library, and I don't remember now where I put it, but Chaim Maccabee, Jewish scholar, maintains that the original story in Exodus would have been that they were to sacrifice their children, their firstborn.
Really?
It's a book on child sacrifice.
So studying the cultures of the day, that's what he concluded?
He concluded, but I disagree with that. I think it's building on that culture. That's why it says it the way it does. And then it says, no, clearly, you are to redeem them.
Do you happen to remember the name of Maccabee's book? I'd like to look at it so I could just...
I'll have to exit and go in the other room. It's called The Sacred Executioner.
Okay. That sounds like a good book.
I bought it at the Graduate Theological Union and then headed for class. And when my teacher saw what I had, he wanted to grab it and take it. He wanted it so bad.
Was that?
It was funny.
Who wanted it?
My teacher, who was also my advisor. It was kind of funny.
I was just going to say, this also makes me think of, you know, this idea of Satan being the one to suggest this test, also being aware that what happens in that story is God's character is revealed too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sue, like you were saying, like any self-respecting God in the day was asking for this. And I wonder if there was a sense of like a double bind that was being set up of like, see, is Abraham really faithful to you? And then if he is, well, then God's just like every other God, right? And it's like, we see that really God's intervention here at the end is going like, hold on, no, I don't want this.
Precisely why I allowed Satan to have this his way is because I wanted to show you that is not what I want. And that is not what is going to happen when Jesus dies.
And that kind of echoes what I think was the double bind that Satan thought he'd set up in heaven, where he basically thought either God had to artificially preserve his life, in which case he could go on, or it would look like God had killed him and he'd win either way. I think this double bind is a reoccurring theme for me, at least in Satan's approach to dealing with God. I mean, what else are you going to do if you're dealing with a God with infinite power? You've got to find some leverage if you're going to go up against him. And this has always been the thing that Satan used as leverage was God's own character.
I love the fact that when we get there and before everything is done, sin and sinners are no more, we are going to see all the details that the Bible left out.
Yeah. Seems to me Isaac had a heck of a lot of faith too. You know, I mean, to let your father tie you up. He was 20 years old.
Oh, yes. I tend to think that since Isaac's God was called the fear of Isaac, that he must have been pretty traumatized.
Yeah, right then. I mean, because he didn't explain it beforehand and just explaining it kind of on the spot, and he lets him tie him up, and he was strong. He didn't have to, but he evidently reflected on the all the miracles that had happened to Abraham and thought, okay, and really must have respected his father. I mean, most kids would say, you're Looney Tune, get me out of here.
There's a story I read, I don't remember who it was by or exactly what the point was, but it went into the trauma that must have happened to Isaac as a result of this. I think the author was looking at his theological abuse by his father. It would have had some significant impact on Isaac.
I think
which is another reason why I don't think it was God sponsored originally.
I don't have as strong a relationship with God as his father.
He knew he was the son of the promise, right? Everything was supposed to be built through him.
Stories of Isaac don't have God talking to him. They don't. They're not like Jacob's stories. They're not like Abraham's stories. Well, God talks to Isaac, but it's rare.
Yeah, he had heard all these stories of God talking to Abraham, and he seems to think his father was cogent and someone to be trusted. And even though he's very old.
That doesn't mean that the seeing that knife about to descend on you isn't terrifying.
Yeah. He must have had nerves of steel. I couldn't do it.
I think of the message it sent to Isaac. He was aware that he was not as important to his father as the invisible sky god, if I may put it that way. What a message that must have sent to him.
But I don't know. Isaac must have had a lot of faith. I mean, he trusted God to find a wife for him. He saw what and heard what God had done, you know, with Sodom and Gomorrah, coming, having lunch with God. And then Sodom and Gomorrah happens and he was born. And he just must have really trusted. And maybe Abraham said, you know, you are going to be the one. We have to trust God with this. He'll raise you back from the dead. I know if this is what he wants. You're not going to be lost to me forever like other gods would just take sons and that's it. No more for interacting with me, but you will come back. I don't know. And maybe Isaac was so into the God of the day thing too, you know, that gods always demand a son and, you know, but that he would be raised back to life. And he must have really trusted God because he was a strong 20-year-old.
I think that it's interesting that the only line for Isaac in this faith chapter is by faith, Isaac also blessed Jacob and Esau concerning their future. It's the only line. So let's move on. Can I pick on David? Would you read verses 20 to 27?
It said 20 to 27?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning on the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's command. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. By faith, he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible.
I apologize. I overlooked 21. By faith, Jacob blessed each of Joseph's sons, and he was dying. That must have taken some faith, considering what Joseph's sons, what Jacob's sons were like.
We mean, yeah, Jacob's sons were a mess.
I do find not only the choice of inclusion, but the choice to exclude. You know, Reuben didn't get included. Judah didn't get included.
Yeah. Well, Reuben was discounted as the firstborn. Judah was passed over for the firstborn.
We are tracing down.
I'm sorry, Levi got passed over as the firstborn. Passed over. Judah was the firstborn. I mean, he was given the right of progenitorship.
I just find it interesting that the author has included very specifically a tracing, in a sense, leading forward, but also there's an intentional, it seems like, exclusion.
Yeah, what could you say had Judah did by faith?
Well, he did protect Benjamin.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's kind of, Joseph is kind of a hero of faith. So that's a little problematic.
Oh, I know. But I still look and I think it took, I mean, maybe that was trust in himself or trust in something else, but there's a lot of weakness within this trusting people. And certainly there seems to be redemption in the story.
Well, even Abraham doesn't explicitly and fully 100% trust God.
Right.
You see that covenantal story in chapter 15.
And Judah seems to kind of repent, you know, taking care of Benjamin. When he's ready to burn a prostitute, then it's pointed out, you're the dad. And he goes, she's better than I am, you know. So maybe the fact that he was willing to listen and change, maybe that's what made him.
But the problem is he's not here in the chapter.
I think by nature, the list is beautiful. I can hear the poetry, the argument from the beginning, slow build, and now it's just like a machine gun emphasis.
Okay, and so let me just argue on behalf of the author. If you look at verse 32, what more can I say? I would run out of time if I told you about.
Right. I was just getting there. He's got this argument, and the exclusion is not condemnatory. He's taking the best of the highlights that everyone understands.
Exactly. And Judah, even though Judah does make a remarkable comeback and has sterling faith, what he did was too egregious for the author to completely forget, perhaps.
Although Jephthah gets mentioned, and I'm not so convinced about it.
I know that. I always tell my students about that when we talk about Jephthah. By faith, Moses was hidden by his parents for 3 months when he was born because they saw the child was beautiful and they weren't afraid of the king's orders. Trust, and I think this is one of the hallmarks of this chapter, trust makes you fearless.
That's a nice thought. You know that saying, no fear, you see people with shirts, no fear. I'd like to be that way.
I will just come back and say Abraham still wavered on that, as we've already mentioned.
I know. Abraham is not ever said he didn't fear. But there's others that says that specifically.
Yeah, I think, I don't know about the idea of having no fear. Just like, you know, the idea of bravery doesn't mean the fact that you weren't scared. It means that you went ahead and did what needed to be done, even though you were scared.
I think that's what's meant here.
Your trust can overcome fear and allow you to continue to act in ways that you wouldn't have without it. But that doesn't mean that there wasn't any fear or any possible, you know, that you don't see the real possibility of everything just completely falling to pieces, but you step forward anyway. Just like Abraham, he didn't know that he was going to get stopped. He really thought he was going to end up sacrificing Isaac. And yet he was willing to do that because he trusted that somehow or other God was going to make this right. I'm not sure exactly how this fits in here, but this last week it was pointed out to me about how during the life of Jesus that there was really only one thing that really seemed to surprise or astonish him or whatever. and that was dealing with people who had either extreme examples of good faith or complete lack of faith, and that this trust is, you know, the basis of any relationship has to be based on trust. The extent to which we trust a person will dictate how deep of a relationship we are able to have with them. Somehow that is all mixed in with, you know, what we've been talking about here today.
And trust is a beautiful word. I like it so much better than faith, because faith seems to be this little magical leap in the dark you have. But trust is based on evidence, experience.
Yeah, Alex has a note here that makes him think of the link between trust and willingness to listen.
And willingness to do, I think. Of what was mentioned before, of like courage being, you know, I'm feeling the fear, but I'm still going to do it. And that kind of willingness to do even what is uncomfortable, I think, can come from a place of trust.
And not only just what's uncomfortable, but as far as being able to, being willing to sacrifice what seems to be in your own best interest for the benefit of others, or just because that's what God is indicating that that's what he wants you to do.
Yeah, I think we don't fully realize how much Abraham gave up when he left the ancient civilization. He was no longer the firstborn. He got to give up all the rights of the firstborn. And then he became the father of a great multitude as a reward. So he had to make tremendous psychological transitions that I think we overlook because we don't understand the culture of the times.
And there was no recognition of, you know, he became a progenitor of a nation nobody saw. That's all.
Oh, no, he never saw the end of it. And that's what, of course, where we're headed for in Hebrews. Any other comments before we close? I think we need to wind it up now.
I was just going to say about the Isaac thing that, you know, in ancient cultures, the father, the patriarch, had the right of life and death over all family members. So, you know, we don't understand how that's illustrated in the story. And the fact that the community was above the individual. And so, you know, they regularly practiced child sacrifice. It sounds so abhorrent to us, but it was just part of their lives. And so it really was a moral example of, you know, God intervenes. He doesn't want us to act this way towards our children and our most vulnerable people. But in a contextual aspect, there would have been nothing strange about that story about offering a firstborn, right, Jean? In ancient cultures, that's just what they did.
What would be strange is the interruption of it.
Yes, that's what would make the story so profound. I mean, that's what's so remarkable about Jesus' parables, is the things in his context and culture that he inserts and turns upon its head. And we don't always get that because we're reading it with Western 21st century eyes. But it's a beautiful story of actually of redemption and care for the vulnerable, those who trust us, that we have, you know, power over, and the most vulnerable. And it's a demonstration of how God loves us. He's willing to intervene and protect us who are vulnerable and need that from our Heavenly Father.
You know, the child sacrifice being so common, you'd wonder why kids wouldn't run away. You know, just I guess you made familiar with them.
They sacrificed infants.
Oh, just infants? Little babies?
Sacrifice, yes. I don't know that I want to get into this because I think our time is fast going. Well, let's end on that note and have our closing prayer. Dear God, we ask today that this chapter of faith may inspire us to trust you in ways when you ask of us things that seem to contradict the way we were thinking you were going. Help us to be able to transition that and to accept it. In Jesus' name, amen. Just a PS, I couldn't help but think about a year ago, I was invited by PUC to retire 3 years early. And that meant a fairly large hunk of money I would lose. And I was struggling with this, and I finally asked God to weigh in. Was this something he wanted me to do? And he made very clear, yes, and for very specific reasons. And I haven't regretted that. He's made it good to me in many ways. My little journey of faith has been interesting, been a bit traumatic recently, but has been one that I can see and trust God all the way.